Okay, so welcome everyone. This is the 7th office hours session for Austrian Economics 1, Praxeology through Price Theory, which is the tour of the first 4 chapters of Man, Economy, and State. We've just got one more week left, and I am here now to field any questions you guys have. So as always on these office hour sessions, there's only a few people right now in the beginning tuned in, so go ahead and fire away. Okay, Lewis says, Dr. Murphy, what's the schedule after Lecture 8? If you mean for this class, there's going to be, so there'll be a quiz, and then, let me pull up my calendar. And then there will be probably a week-long break for you guys to study if you want. And then the final exam will be during the last week of June. And then, then I'll grade those and get them back to you. And then if you're taking the Man, Economy, and State second course, that starts up on July 20th. Okay. So did I answer your questions that you're asking me? Okay. So for those of you who do want to take the next one, you'll still have a few weeks of being completely off, so you can recharge your mind. While you guys are thinking of other questions, let me just say some general remarks. People have been asking, are we going to offer these courses in the future? Yeah, I mean, it's always a function of the demand. We're good Keynesians at the Mises Institute, so if the ability to spend is there, we produce. So this course right now, there's actually 235 people who have enrolled in this first session for Man, Economy, and State. So we'll see what the attrition is going into the second course, but... 235, that's huge for what we've been doing. I'm not sure. I don't know if that's bigger than what we had in the Anatomy of the Fed class, but it's close either way. I don't remember how many we had in that one. So anyway, certainly next year I would reoffer this if we had an idea that we'd get, over 100 students or something, which presumably we would if we had this much this time around. Also, if you guys ever have suggestions for things you would want us to teach, by all means, email them to us, because we brainstorm and try to think, okay, well, look, this kind of class was popular. Why do people like that one so much? And then you try to tweak it and come up with something like that as well. But if you guys are ever sitting around thinking, man, it would be really great if Tom Woods would do a class on the Korean War or something, I don't know that Tom knows about that, but I'm just saying you can suggest stuff to us. Lewis says, how about a class on Mises money theory? Yeah, that would be good. I mean, what we would do is we'd wait, because right now I'm still wrapping up the study guide to the theory of money and credit. So if we were going to do a class like that, it would make sense to wait for the study guide to be available, which we want to have it ready in time for the conference in Vienna that's in September. So working backwards, since that's when we want to have it ready by, that's the earliest it possibly will be ready by. So if I were to teach a class on Mises monetary theory, it would be in the fall or the winter. But yeah, that's a really good, in fact, that's such a good thing. I'm going to email that to Danny Sanchez right now, because I don't want to forget about that. That's a great idea. because going through, there's a lot in the theory of money and credit that it's in, not implicit, it's in Human Action, and it's also in Rothbard, but it's spelled out a little bit more fundamentally, I guess, in the theory of money and credit. Just like I mentioned to you guys in this class, you know, it was sort of an offhand remark, but I mentioned the fact that when it comes to subjective value theory, if you really want to see it explained from step one and dealing with all kinds of objections and so forth, you wouldn't go read Man, Economy, and State right now because it's just that takes it for granted. Like, it just explains how it works and moves on. Whereas you would actually want to go back and read von Bawerk because he was the one who took Menger's approach of subjective value theory and then he start, you know, exposited it and put it in different words and tried to get it across with analogies and then dealt with a bunch of current critics who said, no, that's stupid, you know, cost theory is better. And von Bawerk just went through and, in my opinion, blew those people up. So in terms of having the best understanding of and ability to defend the subjective value theory, you actually would go, need to go back and read what the Austrians were saying about it when it was like, you know, going through a baptism of fire, as opposed to the modern stuff, because now we never get challenged on it because everyone agrees with it, and so it's not a big deal. I mean, we don't really know it that well. So the same thing in terms of, you know, what are the distinctions among money substitutes and money certificates and fiduciary media and what's credit money and what's fiat money and what's commodity money, and, you know, these types of things, now they're obvious to me, but that's just because I'm working on a study guide to the theory of money and credit, so I'm really having to go through it carefully. But if you had asked me before, I've read the theory of money and credit before, cover to cover, but it didn't stick because at the time I didn't know what I was doing. And so, anyway, the point is just that you're right. If we want to understand Mises' monetary theory, it's not enough to read Human Action. It's not even enough to read that in conjunction with Rothbard stuff because there's some real technical things that Mises gets into that are kind of important in the theory of money and credit that just they didn't make the cut in terms of modern exposition because it was just considered, you know, we got so much stuff we got to talk about. We're not going to get into this stuff. Let's do the big picture. You know, here's the theory of the business cycle. Here's the regression theorem. But there's tons of stuff in the theory of money and credit beyond just Mises' explanation of where money came from and the boom-bust cycle, even though that's not too shabby to have in your dissertation the fact that, oh yeah, I'm explaining the origin of money and how you use subjective value theory to explain money, and here's the why we have business cycles. Thanks. Can I get my degree now? So. Well, I'm just rambling at this point, guys, because you're not asking questions, but post a question and I'll talk about something else, but since you're not, I'll just keep talking about this. You know, some of the things that I discovered in there that Mises is talking about, you may have seen the recent Mises Daily I did, that I went to Congress, was testifying there on the possible connection of the Fed quantitative easing policies with rising commodity prices, in particular oil. So basically, you know, is it Bernanke's fault that gasoline so expensive? That was the idea. And Dean Baker, who's a prominent Keynesian economist, was there, and he was sort of the counterpoint to me. And he was saying that, no, the Fed has nothing to do with this. And anyway, the falling dollar, which is partly why oil prices are going up, is because the dollar's weakening against other currencies. He was saying, you know, we need that to happen because we have this massive trade deficit that's unsustainable. The only way we can reduce the trade deficit is if the dollar falls. And he went so far as to say something like, I don't know how else you could do it without a falling dollar. And so I knew something was wrong. Like, in other words, I had thought through these things before, and I knew that there's a lot of different moving parts in such a thing, and that, yeah, if you hold other things equal, a falling dollar can lower the trade deficit, but that's not the only mechanism. There could be other things, but I wasn't really, you know, it wasn't at my fingertips, and if they had called on me, I don't know that I could have, you know, on the spot just said, oh, he's wrong because of blah, blah, blah. I mean, I knew he was wrong, but it just, I wasn't prepared to to discuss international trade and currency movements and that sort of thing. I thought we were more focusing on what the Fed was doing, even though they're all related. So anyway, it just was a coincidence that I flew back to Nashville from D.C. and I went back to writing up the study guide chapters for where I was in the theory of money and credit. And there was a whole section Mises devoted to, there are some people who claim that, the strength of the currency isn't determined by this central bank and so forth. It's determined by international trade, and that if there's a trade, he didn't call it a trade deficit. He said a balance of payment deficit, which because they were back on the gold standard, and so the things were a little bit different. They talked a little bit differently. And he says if there's a balance of payments deficit, then some people say, the currency has to fall, and that the currency strength is not something that the central bank or the banks can determine by the supply and quantity of money and credit. And he showed that wasn't true. He's saying no, it's sort of running around in a circle that the reason there's a trade deficit is because it's cheaper to import foreign goods than for foreigners to buy it from you guys. That's right. So you don't need to have your currency depreciate against the foreign currency. Another way of making your goods cheaper is if the domestic price level falls. All right. And so how do you do that? You stop printing money, and then the prices of goods in your country will fall, not because of an exchange rate change, but because the actual price tags will go down. Right, so it's not just that, American goods become cheaper because the dollar weakens against the euro. No, American goods become cheaper because the prices of things, when you walk into the mall, the price tag has a markdown. So even Americans can buy goods cheaper in America. And that's why they import less and they buy more domestically, is because the goods here become cheaper. And so if that's happening, there's no reason that the exchange rate of the dollar against the euro has to go down. So that's what Mises' point was, and it was just kind of amazing that he literally had a whole section devoted to the very fallacy that Dean Baker was espousing, and I was thinking, yeah, I know I don't quite agree with that, but I don't really have it firm in my mind as to specifically what he's saying that's wrong. I just know it's wrong, and then Mises just lays it out in a whole section. It was just kind of neat. Okay, Benjamin says, do you think there will be any more quantitative easing considering the effect on the dollar and world reaction? Well, this is always dangerous because this is going to be recorded for posterity, and if I'm totally wrong, somebody can dig this up and say I'm an idiot. But yes, I think there's going to be more quantitative easing simply because I think they started going down this path, and how can I put it? If they're afraid to do QE3, I don't know why they were willing to do QE2. That's what I'm getting at. Okay, now if things are a little bit different in the sense that conventionally defined inflation, so rises in the consumer price index and so forth, those things are looking worse now than they were last August when the Fed really started pushing the notion, okay, we're going to do QE2 after the election. So there is that difference. So you could just say, well, no, it wouldn't be arbitrary. The reason they were willing to do QE2 but not QE3 is that before it looked like the downsides of printing more money weren't as manifest, whereas now it looks like, oh, yeah, we're starting to really print too much money because prices are starting to rise like crazy, so we better, we can't do it anymore. We've gone too far. So there is that, but if you're asking for my gut feel, I think they are just committed to this policy. In other words, Bernanke's only solution throughout all of this has been, when the economy starts falling, you inject more money. And as long as, the CPI isn't going up by 10% per month, we're fine. And the thing is, now here I'm going to be totally conspiratorial, but you're asking me, this is part of why I think this. It's not obvious to me that the people running the show want to avoid a collapse of the dollar, okay? Because Because the thing is, it's not just the Austrians who don't understand what Bernanke is doing. Okay, the quasi-monetarists, guys like Scott Sumner and David Beckworth, they don't understand what Bernanke is doing because they think he should be creating a heck of a lot more reserves, right? And they don't understand why is the Fed paying interest on excess reserves. Okay, so I mean, just so you guys know what I'm talking about. The Fed right now is literally paying banks not to make loans to people. Okay, they are literally subsidizing behavior that reduces the effectiveness of their other policies if you subscribe to the standard models that Bernanke and all these guys say they subscribe to. Right. So from the Austrian point of view, it's not, you know, oh man, Bernanke really, his policies would be helping, except he's doing something, you know, he's fighting himself behind the scenes. That's not what I'm saying, because I think printing money doesn't help. But the point is, if you did think printing money helped, well, you're sort of neutering that by paying banks not to lend the money out, okay? Because the mechanisms by which these things are supposed to work are that, you know, it boosts aggregate incomes and so forth, and it counteracts a falling price level, and so we get back onto the trajectory of rising nominal gross domestic product and all that kind of stuff. So if that's the mechanism you think is going to happen, then you're tying one hand behind your back. If you inject a bunch of money into the banking system, you know, by having the Fed accumulate a bunch of assets and then write checks for it, so, you know, excess reserves now are over $1 trillion, but that money's mostly sitting in the banks and not being lent out, and there's various reasons for that, but one of the reasons is the Fed is literally paying banks not to lend the money out. That's what the interest on excess reserves is. Now, that's a small thing, but the point is just, why are they doing it? It doesn't make any sense according to their own explanations for why they're doing what they're doing. Okay, so that's, and then of course the Keynesians also don't understand what Bernanke's doing. All right, so my point is just, what the Fed's actual behavior is not what would be recommended by any school of thought. The Austrians, of course, think he's being reckless and crazy. The Keynesians and the quasi-monetarists think, what are you doing, Ben? You're not doing anything. And then what you are doing, you're partially offsetting it by other policies. What the heck are you doing? Okay. However, if you say, okay, let's suppose for the minute that what Bernanke's doing has nothing to do with helping the economy, that they're just bailing out, you know, they're doing what's in the interest of the international bankers, well, then that makes total sense. You know, with all the stuff they're doing behind the scenes, a lot of the interventions were actually benefiting foreign central banks and foreign commercial banks, a lot of the specific things that the Fed has been doing over the last 2.5 years. So you wonder, well, wait a minute, if they're supposed to be operating to help the U.S. economy, that seems kind of odd, but what if they're not operating to help the U.S. economy, if their first goal is to do what's in the interest of the few people who own all these major banks that transcend national boundaries, well, then the Fed's behavior makes a lot more sense. And so then if you push that, again, I know this sounds tinfoil hat and all that kind of stuff, but it, to me, it explains things a lot better. Say, okay, what ultimately, if you were these people that were really powerful and controlled the media and controlled a lot of international banks and that kind of thing, and you were the ones who funded politicians, and so, you know, it's, you were really, you know, I'm talking about the people that go to these Bilderberg group meetings, that kind of stuff. Ultimately, if they could get to it, they would want there just to be one central bank and one currency for the whole world, one fiat currency, because then they could inflate at will and there'd be nothing stopping them. Right? As it is right now, if the Fed inflates too much, the dollar falls against other currencies and people can flee to other currencies. And so the ability of the Fed to inflate is constrained. But if the whole world is using just one fiat currency issued by one central bank, then whoever controls that central bank has a heck of a lot more power than even whoever controls the Fed right now. All right, so just like, you know, there was monetary union in Europe, and clearly there were a lot of powerful people who benefited from that, and that's why they pushed it. The idea is there are people who would love to see a single currency over all of North America. So if you buy, if you're with the conspiracy theory so far, then you say, well, what do they need to have happen? Americans aren't just going to say, you know, in the middle of prosperity, oh yeah, sure, let me turn in the, my dollars and then you give me an Omero that circulates among Canada and Mexico and the United States and we all have a common currency like the Euro. Americans aren't going to do that. They say, what, are you kidding me? I don't want to have the same currency as the people in Mexico and Canada. That's nuts. So how would you get Americans to do that? Well, if the dollar started collapsing and there was a huge panic and prices quoted in U.S. dollars were rising at, you know, 20% per month, and then Obama gets on TV and declares a national emergency and says in an effort to forestall this panic and this crisis, we're going to do a currency conversion, and everyone turns in their U.S. dollars, and we're going to give you Omeros, well, then they might, Americans might be willing to do it, just like FDR was able to get everyone to turn in their gold in the middle of an awful depression. They couldn't have done that in 1925. Americans would have revolted. So, are you kidding me? I'm not going to turn over my gold. But they did it in 1933 because the president told everyone, we need to do this to save the world economy, or else we're all going to die. All right, so if you're with me so far, then I'm saying, how do you get there? Look at what the Fed's done. You know, look at the injections they put into the monetary base. The Fed has injected more into the financial sector in the last 2.5 years than the Fed has injected in the entire history leading up to that point, right? So from late 1913 to the fall of 2008, the Fed, you know, created so many dollars. And then from the fall of 2008 till now, the Fed has more than doubled that quantity. Okay, so, I mean, they are playing with fire, in my opinion. It does not look to me like they're concerned about the integrity of the dollar. And so the two explanations are Bernanke is just a bumbling fool and doesn't know what he's doing, and the people who are behind the scenes running the show also don't know what they're doing, and they just happen to be really powerful and control politicians and, you know, bankers and stuff like that, and they're just idiots. They just, you know, fell backwards into this position of power. Or they really know exactly what they're doing, and they're just evil. So number two sounds kind of conspiratorial and crazy, but to me it makes more sense than this. There's a boop, boop, let's double the amount of money we've injected in the last, you know, decade or a century, and maybe nothing bad will happen. So anyway, that's why I personally think they're going to keep inflating, is that that kind of makes more sense to me in terms of a big picture than it, that it's just an honest mistake, or that what they've done thus far is actually the right thing to do, and then once it turns out to be the wrong thing to do, they're going to reverse course. So, I mean, I hope I'm wrong. I hope they don't destroy the dollar, but I cannot rule out the fact that they are consciously destroying the dollar. Okay, so if I haven't scared off anybody, I'll keep it going here. Jan Masick says, question, why did gold fall in dollar terms in the 1980s? I would expect it to rise with inflation and fall in deflation, so gold roughly keeps its purchasing power. But Volcker stopped inflation, yes, but didn't bring on deflation, did he? Does it have something to do with Nixon's cutting the gold link from the U.S. dollar altogether? Okay, so what Jan is talking about is gold and also silver. They hit record highs. I would need to go look at a chart to get the exact dates right, but you know, late 1970s, early 80s, they were going through the roof, and then the situation turned around and they collapsed. Okay, and it wasn't until fairly recently that gold prices, you know, exceeded the nominal highs. And then I'm not sure if gold is beaten an inflation-adjusted high. In fact, I don't think it has, but I would need to go check. I don't have that. I used to know that stuff, but I haven't looked at it in a while. I don't remember the exact number. Okay, so Jan's question is, you know, if gold had just been holding its own in terms of purchasing power, so, you know, oh, there's inflation, so prices are rising, so why wouldn't gold prices be rising just to keep pace with it, just to tread water? So if the CPI is going up by 8% per year, well, then gold should be going up by 8% per year. And so, yeah, CPI was rising very quickly in the late 70s, so that's why gold was appreciating. And then Volcker nipped it in the bud, but it's not like he pushed prices down. He just greatly decelerated the rate of growth, or greatly reduced the rate of growth. So why didn't gold just taper off? Why did it crash and then actually take, what, more than 20 years to reach its former highs? That doesn't make any sense. Okay, so the part of what's going on here is gold and silver appreciated way more than the general price level. Okay, so if you looked at the percentage increase in the spot price of gold from 1970 to 1979, it would be much more than the increase in the price of groceries or the, you know, price of a basket of other commodities. You know, so the CPI did not increase nearly as much as gold increased over the 1970s. So therefore, you know, gold went up by more than the actually experienced price inflation. And then, so it's not a mystery as to why gold then had a lot of room to come down to get back in line with where it had been. So I don't know that these numbers, I don't know if this is how it plays out, but my point is just the ratio of gold to the CPI in 1984 might very well have been roughly what it was in 1968. Okay, I don't know off the top of my head, but I'm just saying the ratio went one way by the late 1970s, and then it partially unwound. Okay, so Jan thinks, so did we have a bubble in gold in the 70s? Yeah. It depends what you mean by bubble, but I think so. That people, I think, now it was possibly fueled by reasonable expectations, but I think it was, you know, if you're going to call something a bubble, if you're going to call anything a bubble, I think it makes sense to call gold and silver in the late 70s a bubble, that people were getting into it because it kept going higher and higher, and then it collapsed out from under them, and a bunch of people lost a bunch of money. Okay, now, why were they doing that, though? Well, yeah, I think it does have to do partly with Nixon, because back then people were still getting used to the fact that, holy cow, the dollar's not tied to anything. Okay, so just think it through. I mean, that was the worst price inflation Americans had experienced since World War I. Okay, I would need to check. In World War II, they had a bunch of price controls. I don't know if they ever let the CPI officially go up, but in like 1920, around that period, there were some 12-month periods where price inflation was like 20%. Okay, so you know that was, you'd never seen that in the post World War II era until the 70s was when you started getting back into that range. So from the Americans who were, you know, from their 20s to their 50s in the 1970s, they had never seen price inflation like that, and Nixon in the beginning of the decade had severed the dollar's tie to gold, right? So there's, you know, people now are talking about hyperinflation. Back then, people must have been talking about hyperinflation. Like, holy cow, you know, we're going to be the Weimar Republic. Gold, the dollar used to be tied to gold. Nixon took it off us. Now they've been printing money like crazy. And look at, prices are going up like crazy. That's it. The dollar is going to collapse. And so because of that, people were rushing into gold and silver, thinking when the dollar totally collapses, I don't want to be sitting on a bunch of green pieces of paper. I want to have actual gold and silver. All right, so that's what started fueling it. And then you're right, I think it just turned into a self-sustaining bubble. And then when Volcker came along and nipped inflation in the bud, I think people calmed down and they said, oh, actually the dollar isn't going to collapse next year. That it looks like it is possible we can have a fiat currency and still manage to, you know, go along without the dollar exploding. And so since what had been fueling the huge increase in gold and silver was that fear that the dollar was going to collapse any day now, once you took that away, you know, gold and silver started falling. And then once it started falling, all the people who were in it, not for ideological reasons, but just because, hey, gold and silver are hot, well, they got wiped out and they had to, you know, close their position, so it fell even more. So I think that's what happened. Benjamin says, is there any way out of this economic mess without going through a depression? I don't think so. Yeah, it depends what you mean by the word depression. Here's the way I'm looking at it. You had a big boom in the late 90s. And that manifested itself by the dot-com stocks going up and so forth, but there were simultaneously like real male investments of capital, according to the Austrian theory. That bubble collapsed 2000, 2001. Instead of just letting us suck it up and go through that pain and having the resources get liquidated and moved around to the proper niches, Greenspan pumps in a bunch of money, brings interest rates down to 1%, holds in there for a year, fuels the housing bubble. Okay, so prevents the recovery, true adjustment process, just gets the boom going again. It just takes a little bit different form. We get a few more years of false prosperity. Americans are buying SUVs and plasma screen TVs and stuff. Their savings rate is negative in some years, according to certain measures. That unwinds 2006, 2007. So at that point, if the government and the Fed had just kept hands off and let the economy go through its natural adjustment and recovery process, it would have been awful. There would have been a really bad recession, but you know, we would have gotten through it. They didn't do that though. Bernanke pushes interest rates down to 0%, pumps in, you know, more than doubles the monetary base in a matter of a few years. So we didn't suffer what should have happened. I mean, there was a point there where they thought the whole financial sector was going to go down, major banks were going to go down, and then, oh, no, they're all fine now, even though they made these ridiculous loans for years during the housing bubble years. No, they're still solvent because Bernanke created a bunch of money and gave it to them for their bad assets. Okay? So if you don't think that really fixed the problem, again, there's pushing it back. So it's going to be that much worse now, just like things were worse in 2008 than they would have been in 2002. Things are going to be worse in, 2013, 2014 than they would have been in 2008. So there's no way to get around that reckoning. They just, you know, they can keep buying a few years. It just makes it that much worse and worse. And notice, it's not that you can just keep getting postponing all the pain. Right now, this alleged recovery that we're in is awful. Compared, you know, so the recovery from the dot-com crash was pretty bad too. They call it the jobless recovery. But Americans certainly felt a lot richer in the year 2005 than they feel right now. Even though, you know, there wasn't much job creation in the alleged recovery that was going on in 2005. Okay, so the point is, it's not just that when you keep pushing it back, if we finally allow the depression to occur, that would be more painful than the previous one. It's also that the so-called recovery gets more and more anemic every time you do this. All right, so the point is just, yes, if they just let things go right now, if the Fed just sold off all of its assets and we just let prices do what they were going to do, it would be really bad. And you might call it a depression, but when to say that doesn't mean, oh, so we'd have another 10-year depression like we did in the 30s. No, the reason we had the 1930s is because they didn't just stand back and let the market fix itself. Hoover did all kinds of stuff that was unprecedented at the time. And, of course, FDR took the country the closest to full-blown socialism it's ever been. So that's why the depression lasted 10 years. Okay, so when I say there's no way to get around a depression, I don't mean we have to have another 10 years of misery. No, actually, what they're doing now is going to give us 10 years of misery. And I think it's going to get worse and worse, and at some point, you know, people will say this is almost as bad as it was in the 30s. So if they just let everything go and let the market deal with it, let prices communicate honestly what the situation was, then it's not that would really make things worse, it's that we'd all realize how bad it was and we could deal with it. Okay, what we're doing now is like sort of just drugging the patient and giving them stimulants and stuff and masking the underlying disease. And that doesn't really help the patient in the long run. Okay, so now having said all that, it's what I mean is just if they kept everything else the way it was and just withdrew these temporary extraordinary measures, then we'd have an awful depression that would last, you know, 8 months, let's say, and then a genuine solid recovery would begin. But what if we didn't just undo the so-called recovery efforts? What if they also did a lot of other stuff? So, for example, suppose Ron Paul becomes president. He calls me and says, what should we do? I say, okay, tie the dollar back to gold tomorrow. Have the Fed just start, you know, let its assets expire, you know, mature, and then just replace them with gold and have auditors come in and document how much gold the Fed has so people believe, yep, they really can be back on a gold standard now. You know, take all the foreign troops, you know, end all those wars, bring all the troops home, slash the government budget by $1 trillion next month, get rid of the IRS, okay, not just, oh, let's cut marginal tax, you know, get rid of the income tax altogether, tell people who are on Social Security that are like, you know, in their 40s, hey, you know what, we're not going to be able to pay you anyway, how about you just get kicked out of the system? So, yeah, we're not going to send you a dime. We're sorry about that. We just don't have the money. But as a benefit, as a, you know, to compensate for that, you don't have to contribute to Social Security anymore out of the next 15 years of paychecks that you were going to have to use, or 25 years of paychecks.
Okay.
So I think a lot of people would say, okay, yeah, I'll do that. They would renounce their alleged Social Security benefits that were going to start kicking in when they retired in exchange for not getting taxed on it for the remaining work years. So you start doing stuff like that, get rid of minimum wage laws, get rid of the drug war, blah, blah, blah. You technically would still have that readjustment going on from the depression that I was talking about, but at the same time, you would have an unbelievable explosion in wealth creation and productivity because you're getting rid of all that other stuff. So on net, it might not even feel, you know, it might be fine. So, but at a point that the two things would be counteracting each other. So if all that were to happen, I don't know what would happen. You'd have, the government would have to be laying off people like crazy, but at the same time, private sector job creation would be going through the roof, and so it's not even clear on net whether the unemployment number would go up or down the month after you started doing this stuff. So that's my take on it. So if they just discontinued the stimulus spending and the Fed went back to its pre-crisis policy, there would be an awful depression for 8 months to a year, and then we'd have a solid recovery. But if they also did a bunch of, you know, pro-free market stuff at the same time, that might be able to counteract a lot of that adjustment. And so on net, we would just have like a neutral year, and then we'd start growing at 10% or something. Okay. Benjamin says, what about the effect QE has in other countries, like causing hot currency inflows, inflation, etc.? China has been screaming about QE too, so can the U.S. just ignore the consequences on the rest of the world, or would that cause hostility? I don't know. It depends how crazy they want to be. So like I said, the stuff before I was saying, I'm not confident. I don't know for sure that there is some sinister plan to destroy the dollar. I'm just saying I can't rule that out. I think we need to stop naively assuming, man, the people in power don't want to wreck the dollar. And so, why would they keep doing this stuff if it makes unemployment go up? I don't understand. I mean, you need to, start thinking that, well, maybe the plan is not to help the economy. Maybe they like having high unemployment because then people are dependent on the government. That gives them more power. Right, it's not in their interest to have a bunch of self-sufficient people with private sector jobs and a lot of security, because then when the government comes along and says, hey, let us read your email and monitor your bank transactions to protect you, people say, well, no, we don't need that. I'd rather just be free. But if people are unemployed and they're getting unemployment checks and they don't know how they're going to get hired and the only job is to go work for the government, then they are a lot more likely to let the government infringe on their other civil liberties. So you're asking, you know, there are other constraints on additional rounds of QE besides riots if there's price inflation, right? That there are other things going on. It's not just that Americans are going to get outraged if if prices keep going up, and so wouldn't some of those other constraints possibly get the Fed to not do another round? And one of the things is China and other creditors are getting more and more vocally upset at the fact that if we keep weakening the dollar against their currencies, and they're sitting on a bunch of treasuries, which are promises to send them absolute dollar amounts, right? So we don't guarantee them. When someone lends money to the government, which is what you do when you buy treasury securities, if they're normal ones, if they're not inflation protected, then you're just promising to send them a stream of dollar bills. You're not promising to give them a certain amount of purchasing power. So China is sitting on hundreds of billions, I don't know the exact number, I'd have to go check, of treasury securities. And so as the dollar weakens against the yuan, they're getting less and less in terms of having that money repaid to them that they lent. And so they're getting outraged. I saw a news article recently saying that China is basically saying the U.S. effectively is partially defaulting on its debt to China because we're paying them back with dollars that are worth less than the dollars they lent us, as it were. So, yeah, I mean, that's one consideration. And so you say, well, what would happen then? So if they keep doing QE, they do QE3, QE4, and finally, you know, other people around the world say, okay, we're not lending to the U.S. government anymore, or if we are, we're going to insist on much higher interest rates. So what does that do? Well, other things equal, that would mean the interest rate on treasury debt would go up, the yields would go up. And so if that starts happening, well, if the Fed wanted to, they could just start monetizing all that stuff, right? That the I don't know the exact number recently, but I think in the 12-month period after QE1 went into effect, I want to say that the U.S., that the Federal Reserve absorbed something like 60% of all the net new bonds that were issued by the government in that period. Okay, or actually, no, it was based on the second quarter. But anyway, I mean, don't quote these exact figures, but the point is, from when this crisis kicked in and the Fed started doing the quantitative easing, a large portion of the humongous deficits that Washington has been running, ultimately, those bonds they were issuing found their way onto the Fed's balance sheet. Okay, so for example, I personally don't think the reason they did QE2 was because, oh my gosh, we got to get unemployment down. I don't think the Fed cares about unemployment. I think the reason they did QE2 was they said, we have to make sure investors continue to believe that it's good to put your money in U.S. treasuries. And so we're going to come in and buy up $600 billion worth of treasury just to make sure everyone stays in line. We don't want people to start running for the exits. So far from being an argument against further rounds of QE, I think as more and more people around the world start getting skittish and either failing to buy more or actively selling off their own treasury holdings, and U.S. interest rates start going up, I think the Fed would say, oh, well, we got to step up. We got to buy more to keep down those interest rates. Now, they would say, because we want to stimulate long-term growth and provide job creation and blah, 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 but the real reason would be because the government wants to keep running huge deficits and it doesn't want to have to pay outrageous interest rates. So it's basically just the Fed monetizing the debt through a complicated shell game where the Treasury borrows money from people in the private sector, and then the Fed comes along and does quantitative easing and starts buying bonds from people in the private sector. So it's basically Bernanke is writing checks out of thin air so the government can spend more money than it takes in tax revenue. But they don't call it that because the people would freak out. So to answer your long way of answering your question, but you're right, those other constraints would kick in, but ultimately if they said, we don't care, we're just going to print more money, they could blow through those constraints too. And ultimately the only thing stopping them would be if the dollar collapsed. And again, if that's the end game, then all these intermediate goals are actually good. Because they can say when the Chinese dump treasuries and interest rates start going up, oh my gosh, we can't have American consumers get crushed by these high interest rates. They'll all default on their credit card debt. So the Fed needs to come in and have QE7 and push down those interest rates to protect Americans. Right? So, and then people would look at the monetary base going up and up and up exponentially and say, oh my gosh. And I said, well, no, but we need to do this because look at the Chinese. They forced our hand. Okay, so that's what I'm saying is they could sort of paint themselves into a corner where the only possible outcome is the dollar eventually collapses once people realize the game's over. But, you know, each step along the way, there would be some immediate crisis that they would be responding to. So the fact that you guys are pointing out there'd be all these crises, why would they do it? I'm saying I can't rule out the fact that that's precisely what they want to have happen. Okay. Jan says, I will be at Freedom Fest for the Saturday Mises event. Are you Mises Institute guys coming to the evening party? It's an extra $75, which I'd be happy to pay if you are there. I'm definitely doing, I don't know exactly what, I haven't seen the Freedom Fest schedule. I know I told them, because they asked me, hey, are you going to stay Saturday night? Do you want us to get you into these extra events? And I said, yes. So I'm doing, like, there's a Peter Schiff luncheon and there's something else. So if that's what you're talking about, yeah, I'm going to be there. I don't know if other people are going to be there. I assume they will if they're still in town. So yeah, I personally am going to be there. I'm flying out Sunday. But I don't know, you know, I can't say if Tom Woods or other people are going to be there because I don't know. Actually, I don't even know if Tom Woods is going to Freedom Fest at all. I'm not sure. But the other Mises participants, I don't know what they're doing. But I will certainly be around through Saturday night. I cannot guarantee you, though, that my presence alone is worth $75 on the margin. Okay, we got about 10 minutes left here. Let me make sure I didn't skip anybody's questions. I don't think so. Okay, so oops. I saw somebody's. All right, Benjamin says, what about wage parity in the U.S. with the rest of the world? How can we get jobs back without some change in this area? Well, this is kind of like, you know, Dean Baker saying that the only way to reduce the trade deficit is if the dollar falls. Same thing here. Yes, other things equal, if you want international companies to want to start hiring U.S. workers as opposed to foreign workers, holding everything else equal, what needs to change is, or one thing that could change would be if U.S. wages went down, then that would make American workers more attractive and employers would be willing to shift back to them. But another solution would be for U.S. productivity to go up relative to foreign productivity. And then even with the existing wage structure, it would be more profitable to start shifting your operations back to the United States. So if they – and also productivity, not even just necessarily in terms of physical output, but also after tax – marginal revenue product. So if they just got rid of the IRS and there were no more individual or corporate income taxes, I mean, holy cow, you would see a humongous rush of firms coming in to hire and conduct their operations in the United States, because not only would they not be directly taxed on you know, their corporate profits, so there would be that much extra leeway, but also they could afford to lower the wage they offered to American workers, because American workers would still be getting a higher after-tax wage if there were no more income tax. Okay, so that's a way that, I mean, so sort of goes to your point. They could easily lower U.S. wages, the official wage rate that employers are paying, because the government's not taking a huge cut of it, so that the employees are also getting an increase. So that the employers would think wages were falling, but workers would think wages were rising, because there's a huge gap that the government right now sucks out and would be gone. So so anyway, that's all a long way of me saying I don't think it's true that with the way the world's working and the possibility of outsourcing and so forth, we just, American workers need to accept the fact that they've been living on the hog for a few decades, and that's no longer the way things are going to be. They have to take a huge cut in their standard of living. And I'm not saying you were saying that. I'm just saying that's a sort of general thing that's out there, that a lot of so-called progressives believe that the free market person, that's their prescription. That they say, hey, you know, tough love, school of hard knocks, that's the way the world works, and, you know, either the government's got to do all kinds of interventions and prevent and keep out foreign goods, or else American workers have to just accept the fact that they're going to live like people in Bangladesh, and since we like capitalists, screw the workers, right? That's the way some progressives would interpret the free market position, and I'm saying that's nonsense. If you did implement the sort of program I outlined a few minutes ago, radical privatization, getting rid of all kinds of taxes and so forth, you would see a huge explosion in hiring in the United States with living standards rising. It's worth pointing out that when it comes to this kind of stuff about wage rates and that sort of thing, it's not that American wages are higher than the rest of the world because we're protected from their cheap products. It's that American wages are higher than the rest of the world because American productivity is higher. And it's not the whole rest of the world, but then the countries that have comparable productivity have comparable wages. Right? So the reason an American gets paid more than a Mexican laborer on average isn't that there's tariff barriers keeping out those cheap Mexican goods. It's that an American, on average, can produce more output in an hour than a Mexican worker can. And there's various reasons for that. It's not just that, you know, Americans have some superior DNA or something. I mean, it's because of there's a lot more capital to work with here. The institutions are better. There's, you know, better highway distribution systems and things like that. So, you know, it's not saying that Americans are somehow superior in some cosmic sense. It's just a statement of fact of the way the world is right now. American workers, when they go to work, typically in an hour can crank out more stuff than a Mexican worker can. And so that's why Americans earn more in a competitive market. So it's, again, I mean, this is, again, not that you guys were thinking that, but the people who advocate protectionist policies, they think it's the other way around. They think that American workers are paid more because we're keeping out all the cheap foreign products, and that's not the way it works. Okay, Benjamin, this will probably be the last question, because we've got about 4 minutes left. Benjamin says, a recent CNN poll showed that just under 50% of those interviewed expect a Great Depression within the next 12 months. What are the chances of that? Huh. Well, I don't know what that means. I mean, because the Great Depression, I mean, if you took out the word Great Depression and said a huge economic collapse or catastrophe, I could understand. But, I mean, Great Depression to me means a decade of misery. So you can't have a Great Depression within the next 12 months by definition. You would need to wait 10 years and say, is this a depression, like the Great Depression? If we mean just a really bad economy, awful, you know, unemployment going up to 20%, that kind of thing, yeah, I mean, I don't want to throw out a percentage because that would be a false sense of precision. I mean, if I were to say, oh, I expect a 13.2%, I mean, who knows? Definitely, there is a collapse, a huge crisis in the offing like I said, they're just postponing it with all the crazy stuff they've been doing. If they just stopped and let prices reflect reality, yeah, there would be a huge collapse. There'd be, major financial institutions would go down. Unemployment might go up to 20%. But it would be, if they really did just keep their hands up and said, nope, we're not intervening, we're going to let the market solve this, which they would never, ever say or do, then we'd work through it, again, 8 months, let's say, if you want me to pick a number out of the air. So if your question is now, okay, but suppose they're not going to withdraw their stimulus and all that and just let it happen, will there be a collapse in the next 12 months? I don't know. I mean, people who were, like Peter Schiff, he saw that there was a housing bubble, but he didn't know when it was going to collapse. Mark Thornton in 2004 was saying there's a housing bubble, this is too good to be true, and for several years, people could have made fun of him. He said, you said the housing bubble was going to collapse in 2004, but it keeps going up and up, you idiot. But then it eventually did collapse. So right now when I'm saying this is unsustainable, this is false prosperity, they're not fixing things by just pumping in more and more fiat money, this is all going to come tumbling down. Is it going to happen in the next 12 months or the next 5 years? I don't know. What I'm sure of is, they're not going to just be able to naturally grow out of this. We're not just going to limp along for a little bit, and then things will be fine, and the Fed will just naturally let its balance sheet shrink, and, unemployment will just drift down slowly over the next few years. And so we'll just look back and say, wow, that was pretty rough for a while there, but Bernanke gave us a soft landing, and we managed to get through it. If that does happen, then I'm going to have to seriously revisit Austrian business cycle theory, because that doesn't make any sense to me. But how can it not be totally screwing up the economy right now that Bernanke has held short-term interest rates down at basically zero for the last 2 years? If interest rates do anything, then holding them down at zero through all these crazy measures has to screw things up. And if it doesn't, then I should stop teaching people Austrian business cycle theory, because it's obviously not very important. All right, So I guess I'm not really answering your question, but it's just I don't know what's going to happen in the next year. I guess I would say, going along with my conspiracy theory views, I think they like having Obama in there. So my guess would be they'd want to keep the plate spinning until the 2012 election. But if it gets to be, let's say by February of 2012, if it just looks like, no, we can't keep this going, there's going to be a crash, then they might say, all right, well, we're going to let the Republican win then. Let's just make sure we control whoever the Republican is. It's certainly not going to be Ron Paul. They're going to make sure he doesn't win the primary. And then, so they're going to make sure that whoever the Republican is some tool that's going to do the exact same thing Obama would have done, just like Obama on foreign policy is doing exactly what McCain would have done. Obama on foreign policy and civil liberties is doing what all of McCain's critics were afraid. Oh, my gosh, if McCain won the White House, can you imagine all the stuff? He'd be blowing up people with drones. He'd be saying the American president could just kill American citizens without even a trial. Well, that's exactly what Obama has done. Okay, so whether it's Obama or somebody else, that doesn't matter. I just kind of think they like having Obama in there because he could sort of diffuse, if there's going to be – I've already sounded crazy. Let me go ahead and go the full route with you guys. Why would they want Obama in there? Because when the stuff really does go down, right, if the dollar did collapse and all that stuff, there would be riots. People would be flipping cars and turning them on fire in Chicago and Detroit and so forth. So I think they would rather have Obama be able to go on national TV and tell people to calm down, go back to your homes, violence isn't the answer, rather than Mitt Romney, right? The people who are rioting are going to listen to Obama more than Mitt Romney. So that's, again, but these are not economic considerations. You get what I'm saying? I'm just doing crazy, off the wall, wondering what's going to happen, and I could see people reason along those lines if they're trying to figure out what do we want to have happen 2, 3, 4 years down the road. So I think, in terms of the narrow prediction, they want to get, I think they would want to have Obama get reelected in 2012. And so if they could keep this thing from exploding before 2012, the election, I think they're going to do that. So, to me, it wouldn't surprise me if we can get through another 12 months or even 18 months without everything just completely falling apart. But they can't do it indefinitely, and it might start unraveling before then, in which case I think they would switch and just say, okay, yeah, we can't keep up the illusion. It's going to be the Republicans if let everything go to just totally wreck the economy, so Obama's going to get voted out. We'll have a new guy come in. That'll buy us another 6 months. People will be optimistic about change, blah, 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 and then, you know, we'll just recalibrate our plans. All right, so this office hour recording, of course, will be used later to discredit me, I'm sure. So thanks, everyone, for tuning in. You could say you heard it first, my wacky conspiracy theories. And next week, we have our final session of Man, Economy, and State, our final lecture, wrapping up at Chapter 4. I'm actually going to be broadcasting it from Auburn because I'm going to be down there for the Rothbard Graduate Seminar, appropriately enough. But I'm pretty sure I'll email you if I need to change the time, but I'm pretty sure I can slip away and do it at the normal time. Okay. Thanks, guys.